We're going to have question time now, and please try to keep your questions short and keep them as questions, not statements. And yes, over there.
Could I ask you for a little instruction about demitude in Ottoman and subsequently Turkish lands? I'm puzzled as to why Christianity and Judaism was sustained in the Middle Eastern part of the Ottoman Empire, and now, when the Ottomans have gone, the Christians are going as well. And that seems to be a bit of a paradox, and I wondered if you could help me through that. And the other issue was that in Melbourne we're being subject to a seduction campaign by a Turkish Muslim group who are followers of a man called Gul, whom I'm sure you'd be familiar with.
Yeah.
And I was therefore interested to hear what you might say of Muslim outreach in contemporary Australia, and as to whether that's an effective movement, something that will grow, or something that needs to be challenged.
Yeah. I think the Ottomans were as tough as anyone, really. One of the institutions of the Ottoman was the Devşirme, which was taking one in five children. And that's what the front picture is. It's a collection of the boys, children, boys. It's a Eastern European village, perhaps Albanian or Bulgarian or something, and you see the priest and a lot of women, not many men left. And in fact, they have a former Christian now, a Muslim soldier, who's collecting the boys. The story of the conquest of the conversion of the Albanians is really heartbreaking. They actually saved Europe. They fought against the Ottomans very fiercely, and they were their Christian faith was really stamped out by forced conversion. I just read a recent master's thesis on that. And in New York, I met a Muslim Albanian who'd become a Christian. He spoke about that. He said the Albanians today are still proud of having fought against the Turks. And they know that, they remembered that, but they lost that battle in a sense. So the Ottomans were as tough as anyone, really. It was very patchy. So Christianity in North Africa died out. Judaism survived. I think at one of those early councils in Nicaea, wherever there was a Christian bishop from Afghanistan, all that died out. Other places, but it depended a lot on the local people, how they responded. The Copts kept their language and identity. The Armenians just kept on getting killed, and eventually, but they survived, you know. As for the Greeks, I mean, where are the Greeks in Asia Minor, you know, or Antioch or Alexandria? I mean, the Ottomans, in the end, there was this exchange of peoples, and the Ottomans managed, the Turks managed to wipe out the Armenian and Greek presence in much of Turkey today. We even call it Turkey, you know, we don't call it Anatolia or those old names. So that's one thing. The other thing, Petr Gulen, he's a very wealthy guy who has this network of people all over the world who follow his teaching. And I think he's an Islamist. You know, he's basically the soft edge of Islamization of Central Europe and Central Asia, and where there are Turks and also Turkey. And it's quite a disturbing trend. He's a very dangerous guy. And it's what's really upsetting to me is that the Catholic Church has appointed a Fethullah Gulen chair in Islamic studies in their Catholic university here in Melbourne. And the person who teaches Islam to the Catholics there at the Catholic university is a disciple, and in fact is required by his job description to speak about this man's teachings. But in Turkey, he's regarded as an Islamist and in fact a promoter of a radical Muslim revolution. So that's quite a serious problem. And one of the biggest challenge, in a way, for us in Australia or in Indonesia is a long-term Islamization, where younger generations become more Islamized. Sometimes people say we need an Islamic Reformation. Well, if Reformation means going back to the source, that wouldn't be all that helpful. But what's actually happening is a re-Islamization of certain populations. And in some cases, like Indonesia, an Islamization for the first time. And that's really the big challenge in the long term.
Here.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about this concept in Islam called
Takiyya.
Could you talk a little bit about it? I just wondered if you could just...
There's a verse in the Quran that says that if Muslims are under the protection or the guardianship of non-Muslims, they are allowed to have tuqwa, which is means covering. And what that means is that if Muslims are not in power but are under the authority of non-Muslims, they're allowed to conceal aspects of their belief and teaching for the reasons of safety. I discussed this in the book. I must say, the issue of deception in Islam, I found one of the hardest things to understand. And it was only about a year or two ago that it really made sense to me properly. But it's an issue of safety. And there's this idea in Islam that Muslims shouldn't be persecuted. And one of the protections for that is a permission that allows you to basically say, no, I don't believe that, if you're in a situation where you or your community could be at risk. That means the testimony of Muslims, if they believe this, if Muslims know this verse and believe it, the testimony of Muslims about aspects of Islamic law that could be threatening or cause them to feel vulnerable or at risk of persecution in a non-Muslim society is not reliable. One of the greatest commentators, Ibn Kathir, whose commentary on the Quran you can look up, and if you buy the book, you'll find the verse, you can look it up on the internet, it's translated into English, tafsir.com. He said, what this means is we smile in their faces while we hate them in our hearts. And it's how can you talk about these sorts of things without sounding like a bigot? I mean, Ibn Kathir sounds like a bigot when he says that. But the problem is he is one of the most respected Islamic commentators. His English translation, the translation of his commentary, is the most widely used commentary on the Quran by Muslims around the world today. Someone out there is taking those words seriously. There are other issues to do with deception in Islam, but that's a very big one. So that's, I'll just to summarise that, the testimony of Muslims who are in a vulnerable situation where they're dependent on the surrounding society for their safety is, according to the Quran, not reliable, because they are required, in fact they are permitted, it's a meritorious thing to protect themselves by feigning friendship. And one of the commentators says, you're allowed to be friendly as long as you maintain hatred in your heart. Now, one of the difficult things about speaking about Islam is that I could quote these things and stir up a lot of people to feel indignant and upset. But in a way, I'd really encourage you not to go to that place, to actually just think, allow yourself the time to think through what that worldview feels like, the worldview of someone who fears being persecuted, who has permission to protect themselves, who actually thinks in this way. I've given four or five commentaries on that passage. Have a look at it. I also refer to a number of cases where I've collected from the media where it's absolutely clear that Muslims are acting in accordance with that principle. One of the good things, if you know the Quran, I understand, is that that gives you a grid for understanding when it's more likely that Muslims will engage in this behaviour. They won't if there's nothing at stake. But if their safety is at risk, then it becomes an issue. I'll allow time for more questions.
I just want to say thank you for your talk and your book. I was very interested to read on your blog, and in effect, a theme I take to be central to the third choice is that one of the beguiling suspicions or the hopes of the West, speaking generally, is that there's going to be some kind of reformation in Islam. All of the religions have had long enough and centuries to do so, and yet Islam is still only about 1,400 years old and is yet to come to its acknowledgement about how to live side by side with other faiths. And in your blog you mentioned this wonderful quote. It says, talking about radical Islam, he said, they are the Reformation.
Walid Ali said that. Anyone who knows anything about Islam, he said, knows that Al-Qaeda is the Reformation. Because if you go back to the sources and try and implement them uncompromisingly, you do what the medieval period called Reformatio. Now, Reformation in the medieval period didn't mean making things better, it meant going back to your source. So St. Francis said, look, you know, I had to do what Jesus said, sell everything I have and give it to the poor. So he did what? That was a Reformation. And all the others. So there just happened to be some good things that came out of the Bible in the Reformation. But we just think of it as, oh, they walked away from their faith and became less religious or more secular. But that's actually not what happened in the Reformation. They found other principles of freedom and liberty that they were able to apply to bring change. The problem in Islam is that if you go back to the source and try and implement it more uncompromisingly, you fall into the dhimma. You fall into these verses that say, fight the unbelievers. And in a sense, when Islam is reformed in this kind of normal way we use it, just making it a bit better, it's because it becomes de-Islamicized often. That is, people live their life by other values, by pragmatism, or by just reasonableness, or just respecting other people. It's not actually usually so much driven by their faith as by other values that are imposed over Islam. And that's a really, really difficult problem. There are Muslim moderates who are trying to find another way. They're trying to find a way of being a moderate Muslim, but there isn't there is no movement like Reform Judaism in Islam. There's no Reform Islamism, you know. There aren't seminaries that train Muslim leaders in a different way. In fact, what you see again and again is the seminaries are being taken over by radically minded people who are reforming in the stricter sense of going back to the source.
Yes.
On a local level, what is your opinion about interfaith? And do you find that it's only Jews and Christians that instigate interfaith with Muslims? And the other another question is, what is your definition of a modern Muslim?
Two questions is a lot. Muslims are very committed to interfaith dialogue. Many of them want to do it, but they see it as a subcategory of da'wah, which is the presentation of Islam to the society around it. There are verses in the Quran that encourage them to speak to other people and present Islam to them. That might not always be apparent, but I've read strategies on implementing Islam in North America that include building interfaith dialogue partnerships with Jews and Christians as part of that. So Muslims, I think, will engage, but it's very hard to talk because there's so many things that are really, really hard to talk about with Muslims and very deep issues, such as the ones I've spoken about. It's hard to really engage with those issues properly. Whereas Jews and Christians have been talking about anti-Semitism in John's Gospel or in the Passion narrative in a very deep way, or in Paul's writings. And there's been some really constructive and serious open conversations that have been happening in recent decades about those issues. There is just nothing comparable to that happening with Islam over issues that Christians or Jews might have with Islam or vice versa. And one of the problems is that, the dialogues can end up being kind of, as one Muslim writer said in Egypt, beard kissing. You meet and you're kind of friendly and nice and say nice things about each other, but the really hard stuff doesn't get dealt with. And it still stays there kind of subterraneously, still working its way through. But having said all that, I really believe in the importance of dialogue, interfaith dialogue, 100%. And my experience, for example, in Africa, where there's been a lot of conflict between religious groups, the people there are very committed to it. But it needs to be done from a point of view of being informed. And one of the principles that I started with, I'll say now, you can't rely on Muslims to be the only source of information about Islam. If you're in interfaith dialogue with Muslims, you need to inform yourself about Islam for yourself so that you have some resources to engage in the dialogue. I've used the word moderate Islam. I actually think Islam itself is not moderate. I've read some writings of more moderately minded Muslims, but I don't think there is a kind of a coherent worldwide moderate Muslim movement. And one of the problems is that Muslims that you might regard as moderate, my experience sometimes, not always, but sometimes, they have quite a high level of denial about certain things that are in their own texts. So they'll say those things don't exist or they never happened. And that's quite puzzling to engage with. It's almost desperately trying to salvage their faith by saying that it's not quite the way it is. And I look at those people with compassion. I'd love to be their friends and to encourage them in what they're doing. But when it comes to actually dealing with the fundamental issues, that's not enough of a solution, because all it will take is that they might be discipling some young person in their particular moderated version of Islam. All it will take will be some other brother to come along and just open what's in the Quran or the Hadith to this young person and say, look, that's really what it says. And they'll say, oh, it does say that. So unless you can give a coherent narrative which really engages with those issues, you will not be able to win the hearts and minds of the next generations that are coming along.
I was just wondering about the second choice. I think most people would say in themselves that if they were presented the third choice, they would reject it. So I'd imagine historically a lot of people have pragmatically accepted the second choice. I will become a Muslim.
The first choice is to convert.
They've accepted. So how heavily is that policed? Is it not? I mean, I couldn't imagine any Muslim being fooled by someone saying, "Oh,
right.
I'm a Muslim now." So implications are obviously, you know, if people do follow that path,
well,
how heavily will they be critiqued and observed?
There's a number of cases in history where large populations of non-Muslims have converted while maintaining their secret other religion. So this happened with the Jews in North Africa. I think Maimonides was sort of forced to convert in Spain and then fled to Egypt. And same things happened under Christianity in Spain. We have people keeping Judaism in their heart. But in Albanian, Greek, and Serbian, there are words for having two faiths. There's actually a distinct word in the language for describing someone who is publicly a Muslim but secretly a Christian. And it was a huge thing. In fact, the Catholic Church in the 16th, 17th century would send priests into Albania to minister to whole villages and townships and areas of people that were Muslims. And there's literature in the Christian literature in the 7th and 8th century, speaking about large Christian populations that have become Muslim publicly but still claim to be Christian interiorly. So now, what happens in some of those cases is that the Muslim authorities are very careful to police the transmission. They will make sure that the children are trained in Islam. They will be quite careful in they were well aware of the problem. The other thing is the Muslim authorities were often patient. They knew that although you might secretly keep your Christian or Jewish faith or whatever, in time, if you can reach the new generations, that will die out. And so sometimes Muslim authorities have had a kind of tolerant patience to just wait out that phenomenon. And there have been some times in history where people have been allowed to reconvert. That happened to the Jews in North Africa and the Maghreb in the West. But very often, in time, those two-faith communities have actually just become Islamicized, like the Albanians. In fact, this Albanian guy who was a Muslim became a Christian. He said his father told him that his ancestors used to be secretly Christians, and that's what they used to do. They remember it still in Albania. The Muslims remember that they were secretly Christians at one point.
Can we take three more?
Three more, and I'll try and answer them quickly.
Okay. Yes.
Rather impressed by all this.
I'm sorry.
Another matter that falls into my prognosis as to what's going to happen in the world.
Yes.
So, truth is truth. The thing is, you paint the Muslim religion as a monolithic faith, even though there are differences within the area, but basically, monolithic vis-a-vis their viewpoints on other religions. I accept that. Now that I look at the history of Australia and the future of Australia, I begin to worry about our multicultural society, because one of the edifices of a multicultural society is the state providing succor for religion, so that a Muslim school will get $11 million from the state to propagandize and to organize their strengths in terms of what they think of.
Yes.
And I have moved away from the concept of multiculturalism.
Yes.
When I see other faiths also gaining unfairly from a state purse where they already have schools.
Have you got a question there?
The question is, 400,000 Muslims, 100,000 Jews, the beginning of a nascence of a new faith area in Australia. Australia 50 years hence, where are we heading in terms of this multicultural?
Isn't that a hard question to ask?
Yes.
And one of the problems is that we've regarded religion as a cultural artifact. It's like the kind of food you eat. It's like an interesting quirk of your cultural identity.
Yes.
But religion is more than that. It can be a political ideology that shapes everything about your life. And I think governments will have to draw the line. France is trying to draw the line with the burqa.
Yes,
you know.
Fantastic.
So, and you'll see again and again, nations will need to draw that line. We have barely begun to understand what that means. The basic cafeteria at Monash now doesn't serve bacon and eggs. Well, many people here might not be upset that it doesn't serve bacon and eggs, but having a halal cafeteria at Monash is probably a bad idea. And the country will have, we have lots of issues to face. I just agree. And I think one of the things, if you have the information, you're actually much more, you have the courage to draw the line, to say, look, we're not going to let that happen. This is the boundary. And we haven't had much courage to do that because we're frightened of being intolerant, because we just think of religion as part of culture. But we're going to have to do it. Take heart in Australia. Britain and France are in much worse trouble. The depth of denial, for example, in church leaders in Britain is just horrifying. And we've got the advantage in a way of seeing events unfolding that are disturbing other countries. I see lots of signs of resistance and people being informed in Australia. I think different faith communities are waking up in much more of a way than I've seen in other countries. I have a lot of hope for my country. And this is an issue which will tax the minds of the authorities. And I won't go into more details about schools, because that's a big issue. But I think if people know what they're doing, they'll know where to draw the line.
Yes. I've got a lot of information from Walid Faris's book, Future Jihad. Do you know Walid Faris?
I know of him, but I haven't
fantastic,
read that book.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
He explains all the...
Oh, yeah, I have met Walid, yeah. Yes.
But when he talks about Taqiyya, and he talks about the universities, he talks a lot about Saudi Arabia putting all their money into the madrasas and making everything Islamized and into universities.
Is there a question?
Do you think that the Muslim tendency to lie and deceive has turned Christians against Jews? Like, they use Christian anti-Semitism against Jews to try and destroy Israel. Do you think that you talked about, like,
can I step back from the question and rephrase something?
Yeah.
I think it's no doubt for the Christians in the Middle East that one of their survival hopes is to become an enemy of Israel, and to argue that the Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem will come to Australia and say how wicked Israel is. That's
about the church in the West.
Now, some Christians in the West have bought into that worldview, that testimony. That is, and you'll sometimes hear some Christian leaders say, if only Israel was gone, there'd be peace in the world. That if all the problems in the world are because of Israel. And I've heard, for example, really significant and influential evangelicals in the Church of England who have that view. And they write their books and they argue about it. I don't hear that to the same extent in Australia, but it's a serious problem. There are people in America who believe that, but there are heaps and heaps of Christians who don't. I say a lot of Christians in America are just asleep, and they're basically pro-Israel, but they're not engaged. But my contribution to this is to try and equip Christians in the West to understand that the testimony of abused people who live under Islamic conditions in the Middle East has to be interpreted in the light of the Dhimma Pact. And you have to understand the situation of Israel and the struggle, the jihad that they're facing, in the context of this kind of much larger system. You see, what Hamas wants and Fatah wants is for the Jews of Israel to become dhimmis. And that's quite clear. They've stated it very clearly. They even said, we want the jizya back. And what people need to understand is to analyse what that really means. The problem is that people are told that this was the golden age when everyone was living under this system. And it's just a beautiful, tolerant, peaceful society, in contrast, of course, to what's happening now under occupation. So there are some really powerful lies that are being very widespread. And I believe that this book will have a very powerful effect on Christians in the West in thinking through these issues without taking it head on. Like, my goal in writing the book is not to talk about Israel and the Palestinians, but you cannot think about that whole struggle in the same way after working through this material. You can't think about the testimony of Christians from the Middle East in the same way.
But even if they say there was a massacre in Geneva, there wasn't a massacre, and the Western reporters will report everything as though it must be a truth, even though they actually lie through the teeth.
Well, yeah, and what I say, this is one more thing I want to say, is there is incredible diversity among Muslims. They don't all believe the same. Some are many secular, some hate Islam, many Iranians don't like Islam, they gladly leave it. They have a huge variety of views, so please don't take from me the view that there's this sort of just monochrome Islam or all Muslims are the same. I do not believe that. I've never believed that in my life. But as for the things I've spoken about, do all the commentaries agree on these basic principles I described? Yes. Is Islamic law basically in unity about it? Yes. does the Islamic worldview act consistently with this worldview? Yes. Is there a strong movement to overthrow this worldview coming from the Islamic world? No, there isn't. So that's the point I want to make, not to say, to stereotype all Muslims or to make you think they're all the same.
We're having one more question, and
thank you for tonight, Mark. I'm just wondering, it seems like a lot of security put on this particular talk, and I was wondering if we have a pre-contingent here already in Australia, where are we being intimidated from talking like yourself? Can you do this in a public forum, or is there any issues that you might have personally had it occurred to you as a result of your book?
Personally, for many years I tried, I was quite careful where I spoke. I still am in a way. I wouldn't let my photo go on the internet, for example. But I made a decision about 6 months ago to change that and just to speak out. So I spoke on this at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and the videos on the internet. And quite a lot of things I've said. I spoke about rape. Why is rape a problem in Sydney, for example? There's very difficult things to speak about. So I've made a decision to speak out, not an easy decision to make, as consequences. I think it's wise to take precautions sometimes. It's wise to have invitation only sometimes. But there's a reason. There's a good reason for that. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't speak out publicly. They should as well. But it's not inappropriate to have a meeting here on this basis. People also want to come feeling safe, that they'll be able to ask questions, and that there won't be unwanted disturbances. So I wouldn't in any way criticise. But yes, there is a serious security issue. The fact is people are frightened about speaking about these issues. People will be threatened. People like Robert Spencer, you know, Father Zakaria Boutros is a Coptic priest somewhere in America. He has $60 million on his head from Al-Qaeda. That's what they've offered to shut him up, you know. And this is serious. It does mean something. And so, yes, I'm very, very, very aware of that. And, we've spoken a lot in our family about it, and the decisions. For me to publish the book is, I'm putting my head up, you know, above the parapets, if you like. And
the fact that there is a parapet that you have to put your head over.
Well, there is.
It's an issue.
That is an issue. It's a serious issue. And for me, it takes some courage to engage with this issue, and there's a potential cost to speaking about these matters. This book is quite an explosive book in a way, it can transform people's worldviews. And so I've had to think that through very, very carefully and make a decision, you know. But what I also think through is that 3 weeks ago in Egypt, in Upper Egypt, because there was a rumour that a Coptic guy had violated an Egyptian girl, a whole bunch of Copts were shot and killed. I can explain why that happened on the basis of this worldview. But people are dying and suffering enormously because of these issues. And it's real, and millions have suffered. This is not a small beer, you know, this is a very big issue. And blood is people are giving their blood for these issues. They're losing their lives and their property. And their heritage. The Christians in Iraq have been completely decimated under America's kind of oversight, setting up an Islamic Sharia constitution in Iraq. And these are very profound, important issues. So how can you remain silent about things that are true, that affect people's lives, that affect our rights, our human rights, the rights of our generations? And also, the one thing I often say, it's good to finish with this, is that this system that I've described is very abusive for Muslims. Like it's so demeaning to feel that you're a victim unless you're dominating people, or that you have to be kind of pushing, you know, controlling others. To be an abusive person, abusing husband, for example, is a terrible, terrible place to be in. It's that people need to be freed from that as well. But the conversation has to happen with the Muslim world. We need to ask it to happen. Last year there was a meeting of the International Fiqh Academy, which is set up by the Organisation of the Islamic Conference, and they had a discussion about religious freedom. And it was very clear that those scholars that had gathered all throughout the Muslim world were under pressure over the issue of apostasy laws, because people in the West had been pressuring the Islamic world about the issue of killing people who leave Islam. And at the highest levels they were having to engage with this issue, and they were being forced to talk about it. And I was really pleased to read that. And I'm not naive about whether they're going to change their minds in a sudden, but that pressure needs to arise. We need to ask Muslims to talk about these things. We need to say it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable for the Turks to kind of throw a tantrum every time the Armenians want to recollect the genocide of the Armenians. It's not acceptable to rewrite our school history textbooks and build gratitude to Islam into our school textbooks. It's not acceptable to speak about vaguely about this debt that we owe to Islamic civilization without the facts being properly in place. So I think, you know, for the sake of the Muslims of the world, as well as the non-Muslims, these issues need to be brought out into the light of day. Can I say something?
Yes.
There are copies of the book for sale for $20.
I was going to say that.
And can I say, yeah, if you buy three, it's $50.
Well, I just wanted to thank Mark for coming tonight and giving us this important information and knowledge. Knowledge is power, and so now we've been empowered further with important information that will help us to read things more clearly, read the newspaper more clearly, hear information slightly differently. The book has a lot more information in it too. We have it available here. So please, if you'd like a copy, you can buy it, purchase it here. We also have a few of Bachir Orr's books outside, and those are for sale as well. And thank you all for coming and listening to information, which isn't the easiest to listen to. We appreciate your presence. Thank you.
Mark, but before you get carried away, I need to make a couple of points to you.
This is very important.
Not recently, but in the past.
I saw him for lunch for the transcript on Monday.
I'm very happy to meet you.
Religion and science.
Yes.
And,
And I was the person who gave the thank you, because I've got the notes of what I said. I just uncovered it all.
Amazing.
So, were you really arrived at the... Did you come at, on time? Did you come here on time? So, were you there at the beginning? So, the remarks that Mark made at the very beginning about what God is going to talk about Islam.
I think I've seen them already.
What precipitated by all guests that Ronix and I invited who declined, all for the same reason. Rabbi Jonathan Fehrenblatt, Rabbi Kenard, Yossi Aaron, Zabir Abramovich. Four of them said variations. Why would I want to go and hear a Christian woman talk about Islam? If I want to hear about Islam, I should hear a Muslim. And therefore I'm not coming. There were variations on that thing. And so I asked Mark to speak to that issue, because he chooses an issue, he's going to be listening to the lecture about Islam.
In Grand Rapids, which is a very influential place. Some people are very open, they've already thought about it.
Okay.
One woman was his wife, she's a sheik.
Yeah.
And she went through, she said, I've got a lot to learn.
Yeah, so that's good. It's pretty confronting.
But yeah, people are open, but they vary.
Yeah.
They vary. I have a lot of openness. There's a lot more openness in Australia.
Yeah. Did you see in today's Australian that there was actually a comment on Islamic migration?
I didn't see that. Yeah.
Saying it was it has to be viewed differently. Anyway,
we'll
let you go.
Oh,
very good, Mark.
Thank you
very much.
You know Paul, don't you?
Yes, of course.
All the best. Bye-bye.
I'm happy I agree that after your talk to Paul, you can post that I've got to get with five other women where you will be a factory about what's going on. Our whole thing is to be action oriented on the ground, and maybe we can have you as a resource in some sense.
Happy to help in all
but
way.
We're very committed to doing this.
Wonderful.
So thank you for giving us that sort of inspiration to do. And I did buy your book back then, which I'm feeling out here before. But I'd love you if we gave mine because I'm so committed to
it. Well, I have signed it. What is your name?
Do you know that?